Hello, listeners. Welcome to Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, we are looking ahead to June 5th. Eight states have primaries on Tuesday, including California, where the unusual primary system has Democrats worried about some of their top House target districts getting wiped off the map 5 months before the general election. We'll explain more in a moment. Plus, what does the White House have up its sleeve for the rest of the midterm year? We're breaking down the political plans emerging from the Trump administration, starting with the president's rally in Tennessee earlier this week. A quick reminder before we get started to our listeners to subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a review. And stay tuned for the end of the show for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. One more note before we begin, we are taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, May 31st, so it is all up to date as of then. Okay, let's get started. I want to welcome into the studio Campaign Pro's House expert, Elena Schneider, back from the road. Welcome, Elena.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, let's jump into our first data point, 1.4 million. That's how many people have already voted in the primaries in California, according to early voting data from Political Data, Inc. One of eight states, California, is up on June 5th, a little bit of a midterm Super Tuesday. We've got Alabama, Iowa, Mississippi, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, South Dakota, and California, which is the main event. And because the state has a top two primary system, Democrats are concerned they might not get nominees in as many as three Republican-held House districts, where Hillary Clinton actually got more votes than President Donald Trump in the 2016 elections. Elena, walk us through the situation. Which districts are we talking about here, and why wouldn't a Democratic trending district have a Democrat on the ballot in November?
Well, you've hit on a really big issue for Democrats right now, where the panic level has slowly and steadily increased over the last couple of months and weeks. We're heading into a primary situation in which we've got three districts in Orange County. So this is a county that, as you noted, voted for Hillary Clinton first time in a number of cycles that they had backed a Democrat for president. This was sort of seen as the Orange Curtain, a place where conservatism was strong, had delivered Ronald Reagan.
This is like where modern conservatism was born.
Exactly.
Arguably.
And they voted, not unanimously, but voted against Trump and supported Hillary. And so Democrats see this as a key place where they could flip some significant districts to get on their path to taking back the House. And the issue is that there are so many Democrats who are so excited to run for office that all of these races attracted dozens of candidates. And the fields have thinned, but not enough. And those well-financed, credible campaigns are now all trying to, jockey for the same pool of voters, and that dilutes their voting power.
And unlike in almost every other state around the country, the primary system here is set up such that it's not a bunch of Democrats running against each other and one of them advances. A bunch of Republicans run against each other and one of them advances. They're all crowded on the same ballot. Right.
We're on a jungle primary system, which a couple of states are on, in which the idea of putting this forward was to, in a place like California where there are a lot of blue districts, that you would get a different shade of that blue, that different kinds of Democrats would be able to compete and get a different shade of representation. But that's not actually what's coming through in these battleground districts. Instead, these multiple candidate fields are spreading out the vote and allowing for well-funded, credible Republicans to come through and be potentially the general election nominees. And it's particularly concerning in two open races where Ed Royce retired and Daryl Issa retired. And then also in a third district where Dana Rohrabacher is running for re-election, but he's got a significant challenge by Scott Baugh, former state legislator, former party official who has run a well-funded campaign, and Dana himself has sort of cratered in his popularity in the district. And so along with then several well-funded candidates who are running against each other. So in all three of these places, there's a very real possibility that Democrats could wake up on June 6th and realize that they have no one to vote for in November.
And we've seen this happen before. In 2012, which was right after redistricting, it was kind of the first year that this was the new system was implemented in California, Democrats were really excited about picking up the 31st district, which is a little further inland than what we're talking about now in San Bernardino County. But two Republicans ran against four Democrats, and the two Republicans split 50% of the vote, about 50% of the vote, almost evenly. And the four Democrats kind of split their 50% of the vote a little more thinly, and two Republicans advance in a district that I think President Obama carried that fall with something, you know, mid to high 50% of the vote. But it had a Republican member of Congress for two more years until he saw the writing on the wall and retired because, you know, the district was not necessarily meant to elect one, but because of this system, it happens.
Right, exactly. And that race in which Pete Aguilar, who now represents that area, who's a Democrat, his loss in 2012 haunts the dreams of the Democratic Congressional Committee forever because they don't want that to happen. And so that's part of the reason why they've made it clear over the last 2 years that we've been writing about these House races that they plan to get involved diplomatically and militarily in these primaries to win,
you know, metaphor.
Because that's how they feel like they want to prevent that again from happening. And the only problem is that how to do that, especially in this post-2016 environment, is a very delicate proposition. So there, I was out and talking to a number of voters in all three of these districts, and some of them felt like, look, this, we do want the party involved. We do need help thinning these fields. We want to know who's going to be best fit for this, which is in striking contrast to the reaction that we saw in Texas 7, where they intervened against Laura Moser. And in fact, people said the exact opposite and said, that's a reason why I want to vote for her. I don't want them coming in here and telling me what to do. I heard echoes of that in California, but I think there's a recognition in California that because of the top two system, there's sort of a very unique situation there. And so it's going to be really interesting to see who gets the blame if they fail to get a Democrat through in any of these in these districts. Who are they going to point the finger at? And it seems inevitable that it's going to get pointed at the party.
Yeah. It's worth noting that Laura Moser lost more than 2-1
right.
in that primary runoff, right? So, like, maybe the noise was not representative of what actually mattered to voters in terms of that perceived backlash to party intervention.
Well, to be fair, though, I think Jason Weston, who lost, who came in third in that
primary
down in Texas, would argue that the D-Trib helped Laura into that. Again,
that's a good point.
That is somebody who then obviously lost, so he had a reason to feel that way. But bottom line, it definitely gave her a boost. It gave her a short-term lift. It gave her a short-term money boost. And it's a treacherous thing to get involved in.
Right. But not a boost into, like, majority
right.
or even contention for a majority.
Right, exactly.
Let's jump back into California. So you talked about, like, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has known that this could happen for years,
right.
And then specifically with this cycle, has had their eye on it for a long time. So what are they and other party groups doing about it right now?
So in let's go through all three districts. So in California 39, which is one of the open races to replace Ed Royce, they are spending against Republicans, so in an effort to sort of dilute the Republican vote. But then also they endorsed and added Gil Cisneros to their red to blue list, which is basically their tacit, you know, endorsement of saying, look, this is the person that we want to get through this race. And they are obviously boosting him, but he's somebody who's been able to, as a self-funder, spend much of his own money in that race. As of right now, I don't think that they've done any positive for him. They've just focused on trying to...
I think they have, actually. I think they've done some Spanish language ads.
That's totally true. They have. They've done Spanish language ads in conjunction with him to try and boost him in that voting block.
El candidato demócrata al Congreso, Gil Cisneros, cree en el sueño americano porque lo ha vivido.
But they've also spent against Republicans there. Down to California 48, where Dana Rohrabacher seat, they have spent against Scott Baugh, who is the Republican running there. And they've also boosted Harley Ruda, who's the Democrat who got their endorsement pretty late in the game, actually, but who got their endorsement and that they're doing a coordinated buy. So that means that they're spending with the campaign with positive messaging on his behalf against Hans Kierstedt, who's the other Democrat the other top Democrat in that race, who initially had sort of was recruited into the race by the committee. The committee soured on him. They've now started supporting Harley. Then we move down to the 49th, in which there is a whole, you know, four Democrats. They haven't chosen to endorse in that race, and instead they've opted to spend against Rocky Chavez down there and try and
who's a Republican,
and focus rather on driving up Democratic turnout. So those are three very different approaches that they've taken to each of these races to try and address these issues, and certainly I think in the 49th there was a feeling that they wish that they had sort of come in more clearly because the California
among some voters.
among some voters because the California Democratic Party also did not endorse in that race because there were so many candidates. So there just overall was the sense while I was down there in every one of these districts of just chaos, of chaos and confusion and agony over who's the best candidate. I'm not sure. And there's very, you know, there's a dearth of polling there. It's just there's a real anxiety about what might happen.
I thought your story was really interesting, just like getting into what's going through voters' minds as they try and sort through all this.
I think that it's a lot to ask of voters to say to them, not only should you find a candidate, but you also need to think about the candidate that's going to get through a primary. That's not something that...
A 12-way primary.
Exactly. That's not something that we ask of, you know, that operatives or candidates or parties ask of voters to do often. And it's a really big lift. And it's one that they're all taking very seriously because they are so activated by this, but it also then, you know, I also came across people who had no idea that this was potentially going to happen and were suddenly very anxious about it. So it's
how rude of you to
to
bring that upon
them.
their heads. But as you notice, the other problem here is that there's almost never public data in House primaries, right?
Right.
So and there's been a little bit that the campaigns have released, and although you always have to kind of look at campaign internal polling with a grain of salt, and
big grain of salt.
Yeah. So that's a tough situation for the voters to try and sort through that. Broadening out a little bit, like what else are you kind of keeping an eye on Tuesday? California is going to be the main event, but we've got some other states with potential House battleground races on tap in November. We've got some Senate and governor's races percolating in California as well as some other places.
Yeah, we've got a lot of really interesting battleground races that we're going to get some answers on. Take Iowa. I think that we've got two key races there. The Democrats are watching really closely, both Iowa 1 and Iowa 3. Iowa 3 is one where we've got it's sort of, again, another one of those sort of very three people are running in this race, and one is taking very much the Bernie Sanders route, so much so because he's appearing in his ads. He
worked for Bernie Sanders.
Exactly. He ran his Iowa operation. This is Pete D'Alessandro, and he's somebody who is certainly taking that Sanders route. And I just spoke to him this morning, actually, and part of his argument was that he feels like Democrats need to focus on drawing out those independents who are leaning progressive. And that's a tack that he's going about this. So sort of expanding the pool as opposed to trying to do Republican persuasion work. And he's obviously running against Cindy Axne, who got support from Emily's List, Eddie Morrow, who's dumping his own money into the race. So I know we've got some more.
Like a lot of archetypes.
Exactly.
Of House candidates
a lot of the same trends that we've seen in these primaries coming up over and over again. But that's going to be one really interesting to watch. And another element out of California that I think is really fascinating is in two districts, we've got candidates who ran in 2016 who stepped up in a year where arguably Democrats were sort of in a tougher position to run down ballot and chose to run again in 2018 and have expressed some real frustration that the D-Trip has not come in and supported them in a real active way. So I'm talking about Doug Applegate in California 49, which we were just talking about, that open race. He ran in 2016 and he nearly beat Daryl Issa by about 1,600 votes, came up short. And he told me when I was there with him last week, said, you know, it felt like the D-Trip had invited me to the dance and now they've stood me up. He hasn't gotten the same sort of support that he did last time. So it's a question of, is somebody like that or Brian Caforio, who's running up in north of LA in California 25, who also has another really contested primary. He was somebody who ran in 16 and hasn't gotten an endorsement from the party. And so I think that it's going to be interesting to see what kind of residual name ID will come out of those races and whether or not they're going to be able to hold on to that, or if people are really opting against, you know, white dudes.
That's going to be interesting to watch. A couple other things that I'm keeping an eye on in California are, we've talked about this a little bit before, like I'm curious to see if the Republican share of the vote is near or below 50% in any of these potential battleground races, because we've seen in past years, especially in 2012 and 2014, 2016 was a little weirder because you had the Democratic presidential primary still going, but not the Republican one, and so the voting was a little lopsided. But in 12 and 14, you saw in a lot of these battleground districts in California where you have the all-party primary, the Republican vote in the primary is kind of like a ceiling for like what you're able to accomplish in the
right.
general election, and a lot of them fall below that. And so you have to think that in some of these target districts, if the Republican share of the vote is even near 50%, but definitely below it, that could be a big danger sign for
For turnout in November.
Exactly, exactly. Right. And then, you know, on top of that, we've got in the governor and Senate races in California, there are real questions about whether or not a Republican is going to be able to qualify through, you know, it's the flip side of the top two question, right? Republicans got locked out of the 2016 Senate race in California, which Kamala Harris eventually won. But in the governor's race, you know, President Trump has endorsed John Cox to try and boost him through. And there's, you know, question about whether Kevin DeLeon, the progressive former state Senate leader, could end up running in the general against Dianne Feinstein in a Democrat versus Democrat race. So that should be pretty interesting, too.
I think another element to this is that if Democrats are able to lock out Republicans in not one but two statewide elections, that's going to do a lot to potentially depress turnout on the Republican side. It is a lot harder to run a campaign to convince people to come out and vote for a House campaign in an expensive media market like L.A. if there's nobody else who's helping you higher up on the ticket. So that is something that Republicans are going to be watching as well, as how that might hurt them in November.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, it seems like some in the party have already kind of turned their eyes toward a ballot measure to repeal the gas tax as a potential turnout driver instead, which I think is really interesting. And we've seen House leadership and also Congresswoman Mimi Walters from Orange County and some other California Republican in Congress pour a lot of money behind that effort, which I just think is really interesting. One other race I want to flag before we close out this segment is the South Dakota governor's race. I know it sounds super exciting, but for those of you who don't live in South Dakota, I just think that it's another example of a Republican member of Congress, Kristi Noem, who was elected in the Tea Party wave in 2010, is now going home and running for another office, but is getting hit a little bit on that kind of connection to Congress by her primary opponent, Attorney General Marty Jackley. And we've already seen some pretty mixed and to negative results for
members of Congress trying to seek a promotion.
Exactly, exactly. And I'm very curious to see what happens there next week. There was a poll that came out yesterday that showed Noem and Jackley pretty much tied, 1 point separation, and 10% undecided with a week to go. So,
the 12 people in South Dakota who live there, tell us who you want to support.
Oh, well, all right, yeah. I'm sure the Nerdcast is very popular in South Dakota. I'm sure. we're ordering up the stats on that right now. Elena, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back, and thanks for walking us through the situation in California.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to go do laundry now.
All right, let's jump into our second segment, and we are changing out the guard in the studio for this one. I want to welcome in Charlie Mattesian, senior politics editor. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Scott.
White House reporter Nancy Cook, our Nerdcast regular. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Scott.
And making his Nerdcast debut, Politico's brand new Senate campaigns reporter, James Arkin. James, thanks for being here.
Yeah, good to be here.
James, all right. Do you feel the pressure?
Tons.
All right. Our next data point is 26 percentage points as we flip from next week's House primaries to kind of the Senate landscape and the emerging battleground in 2018. 26 percentage points was President Donald Trump's margin of victory in the state of Tennessee a couple years ago. And that's a big reason why he was in Nashville on Wednesday with Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn, who's running for Senate. Despite that margin, she faces what's shaping up to be a pretty tough race against a former two-term Democratic governor, Phil Bredesen, who's still popular. And Republicans are hoping Trump can leverage his popularity to help lift Blackburn onto equal footing in that red state. It provides a bit of a preview of what the White House is planning politically more broadly this year. So, James, start us off. Take us inside a little bit. What prompted Trump's travel to Tennessee and the appearances he made with Marsha Blackburn?
Yeah, simply put, this is a state that Democrats feel pretty good about where they are, and Republicans are more worried about it than you would think they would need to be. I mean, as you said, President Trump won it by 26 points. Tennessee hasn't elected a Democrat to the Senate in almost three decades, but Phil Bredesen is really popular. He won every county in the state last time he was elected governor, and he's been leading in most of the public polls, all of the public polls, actually, I think, that we've seen in the race so far. And so they deployed President Trump to do what he does best, to, you know, go out and attack Phil Bredesen, to criticize him publicly, to give some fodder for what I assume we will see in campaign ads coming forward. And it's an attempt to do two things, kind of show that Marsha Blackburn is going to be his ally in the Senate and get all the Trump supporters who voted for him and who still support him to vote for her, and also drag Phil Bredesen down to try and, you know, drag him through the mud, paint him as just your average Democrat. That'll make it much tougher for him to win there.
And I mean, this is not going to be a one-off, basically. I mean, we've seen a little bit of it already, but the White House is kind of gearing up to do this more in a big way in other states around the map that have similar leanings to Tennessee, right, Nancy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there is a plan inside the White House political shop. I would say that there's, you know, different factions in the White House that are trying to run the politics operation. So that's a caveat to say that there's sort of different thoughts on
this. So this could all change. This could all change by the time the Nerdcast comes out on Friday morning.
No. I think like this basic strategy will be in place. My point is there's just like different people sort of vying for dominance in that shop. But I think the basic strategy of really targeting vulnerable Senate Democrats in these red states that Trump won will continue to be a big thing. And I've been told, you know, by administration people that part of that is going to be to use. Someone told me, you know, Trump's poison pen on Twitter to really bring them down, you know, said in a menacing way to me, but also sort of delightfully. But I think that also, you know, there is a sense, too, that Trump is very good at defining opponents. You know, the New York Times had this great piece on midterms where they quoted Rob Collins, who's a Republican strategist, sort of calling Trump the definer in chief. And I think that that's another way the White House plans to use him, because he is so masterful at branding and giving his opponents, you know, little nicknames, as we saw during the 2016 campaign. And he's really good at distilling his opponents' weaknesses into these nicknames. And these nicknames tend to stick. And I think that the White House sees that that can be a way for him to play a big role in these races, too.
Charlie?
I think the travel, there's a strategic dimension to it. But I mean, for the most part, it is really just reflects the seat of the pants decision making, the narcissism and the chaos that drives most of what we see coming out of the White House. I mean, that's really the recipe for so much of what happens there. And what I mean by that is the president is going to go to places that dovetail with the Republican electoral agenda, meaning the red states where they feel they have the best pickup opportunities, and Trump will be very useful in those places. I mean, he won, when you take a look at them, many of those states handily in 2016.
And we're talking West Virginia, Indiana, Montana, Missouri, and North Dakota, right? Those are the five Democratic-held double-digit Trump states on the Senate map.
Democrats are protecting, as you know, incumbents in 10 states that Trump won. Five of those incumbents, you know, including some of the ones you just mentioned, represent states where Hillary Clinton could not even crack 40% of the vote. She couldn't even win. The Democratic nominee couldn't even win 4 out of 10 voters in those places. So, you know, those are the kind of places where he's still popular. He can't go to many other states, and so he needs to lock down his base. And I think the underpinning for all of this, the strategic underpinning is, I think they're beginning to wrap their arms around the idea that the president, the 2020 reelection is not going to be a standard reelection where the goal is 50%. They're not going to win a majority. It's just going to be like the Clinton presidency where both terms, if he wins again, will be with under 50%. And they've got to figure out how to make that work. They won 46% in 2016 to claim the presidency. And I'm sure they're working on what the number is to get them to a second term, but it's not going to be 50%. And so that means much of the map is going to go untouched. They have to figure out how do we win the states we won last time, and where might we expand? Is Minnesota an option based on what we saw last time? Are there other states? But for now, at least in 2018, why not stick him where he has the most impact, and that is the red states that we talked about.
I mean, I think the tricky thing for the White House is, you know, Trump has traveled twice this week. He's going to Houston today. And, you know, he was in Tennessee earlier this week. But the tricky thing for the White House is twofold. One, the president doesn't really love to travel. You know, he likes to go to these campaign style rallies, but come home. So he doesn't like to go to places where he has to stay overnight. So that's a tricky thing for, you know, the White House political shop. They can't sort of have him do a bunch of events over a few days. And then the second thing is that the president himself is very, very focused on keeping that conservative base in line. And that's sort of a touchstone for him. And he always goes back to that, to making sure that they're happy with his policy decisions. But it becomes trickier with things like, you know, trade and immigration, which have really been heating up lately, because those are things that, you know, Republicans broadly don't always, you know, he sort of changed the way the Republican Party has approached those issues, and they don't always, not everyone is sort of in lockstep. So like, for instance, with the policy that Jeff Sessions put forward about 100% prosecution at the border on immigration and separating families from children as a deterrent to get people to come to the country. I know I'm going down in the weeds, but there is a point here. That is something that I think the president really sees as appealing to his base. However, I see that as a policy that really could potentially alienate, you know, more moderate Republican voters, particularly suburban women.
And then meanwhile, on trade, you've got an interesting dynamic where that's, again, another issue where Trump has kind of changed the way the Republican Party thinks and talks about this, but in a way that potentially dovetails with what some of those Democratic senators in North Dakota and Montana, Ohio, you know, other states who have tough races, kind of gives them an opening to maybe flip back some of those Obama-Trump voters. Right,
yeah,
James?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think an interesting example in that is Ohio. I mean, it's not one of the top races that we're going to see this cycle in terms of Senate races, but it's one where the Republican candidate is a pretty traditional free trade Republican. Jim Renacci is a congressman. Meanwhile, Sherrod Brown, the Democrat, is totally in line with President Trump on these trade issues. And it's really completely flipped the script. And we see other examples of that. So that's, you know, to your point, that's an issue where he kind of, you know, isn't in line with what we would consider traditional Republican values on trade. And that does give Democrats a real opening with a lot of the voters that he won in 2016 in these states.
James, what else is looming in some of these big Senate races that we're talking about that President Trump is going to be heavily involved in? We've got a primary coming up in Montana on the 5th, along with all those others, where you know, whoever comes out of that is going to presumably get the weight of the White House behind them and quickly.
Yeah, Montana's the next one in line. We have a couple of primaries left. That one, you know, coming up. And that's a race that's kind of, it floated under the radar for most of the cycle, right up until John Tester, the Democratic senator there, was, you know, involved in vetting and sinking the nomination to, you know, for Trump's pick for, to lead the VA. And that Republican primary, it's been a fairly nasty primary in the last couple of weeks. The candidates have been kind of coming out and attacking. There's been a lot of outside money spent. But it's sort of a sleeper race in that they didn't get their top picks. The party didn't get their top picks to run there. There are a couple of different candidates. Matt Rosendale, the state auditor, is kind of thought to be the front runner. Most expect him to win there. But, you know, he hasn't lit up fundraising numbers. It's been a lot of outside spending on his behalf to lift him there. So he's going to need the full weight of the White House to, you know, if he's going to defeat John Tester. I think even just a couple of weeks ago, a lot of Republicans, Democrats thought Montana was kind of falling out of the top tier of these races just because Tester was popular there and they didn't really have a set great candidate that they were going to be able to rally behind. That's changed a little bit. But yeah, that primary is going to be really interesting to see you know, how much the White House wants to get involved for Rosendale after.
I want to jump back to something Nancy mentioned earlier about the definer in chief role that Trump plays. Did he tag Bredesen with a nickname while he was in Tennessee the other day? Or
I think the most memorable line was when he said, "Phil, whoever the hell he is," didn't even give him his full name.
Phil, former governor, whoever the hell that is.
Yeah, exactly.
Sleepy Phil. Phil, whatever the hell his name is, this guy will 100% vote against us every single time.
Well, see, that's the thing, though. He tagged, you know, Joe Donnelly in Indiana as a sleeping Joe. And I kind of feel bad for some of the Republican strategists working on that race because they spent the whole year before that trying to make Mexico Joe happen because of outsourcing by the family company that Donnelly used to be a part of. But now, you know, they just had to switch tacks and to sleeping Joe because Trump came in and decided that's what it was going to be.
Well, it goes to show you how hard it is to actually make it stick. I mean, politicians have tried it since time immemorial, and it never really works, and it sounds lame and sort of pathetic and artificial. And Trump turns out to have a gift for it. It's, you know, with the Jeb Bush criticism, the Lion Chuck or Crying Chuck and Little Marco, and I mean, he's got all kinds.
What was Ted Cruz? Lion Ted?
Or? I thought it was Lion Ted.
Lion Ted. And low energy Jeb.
Dickie Durbin. Sneaky Dianne Feinstein. Seriously,
Wait,
that's
how do you remember all these?
You know Bernie Sanders because they stick in your mind. Crazy Bernie is Bernie.
And there was there was Crooked Hillary.
Crooked Hillary, Pocahontas as Elizabeth Warren. Yeah. I mean, so this is a guy who thinks about it a lot. And I think it also just shows you how his mind works.
Charlie, one thing we haven't mentioned is, you know, obviously Trump is going to be traveling to, and you said he's going to be focused on kind of remaking the Trump coalition to get behind some of these Senate candidates. But something he's going to be able to do to help candidates who are running in states where maybe a visit wouldn't help as much is fundraising. And we're seeing, you know, the Republican National Committee raising a ton of money. And we also, our colleague Alex Eisenstadt had a big story the other day about Trump actually planning to attend sometime in the near future a super PAC fundraiser for the kind of main group the unofficial like flagship group backing the White House, and which could be involved in the midterms in a major way.
Yeah, I think it's an important distinction that you're making right there, that the president is very popular in some places and can go to some places on the Senate map, yet in other places, you know, he would be a disaster. You know, a perfect example of that, a really interesting example, and you know what state I'm going to say, it's Pennsylvania.
You were going to say California, honestly.
Can you imagine Trump going to California?
But I do want to make this point. Like, he does not like to go. He did go to California finally, but like, he broadly does not like to go to places where he is not liked and where there are protests.
He doesn't go out of his comfort zone. If you take a look at the map of his presidential travels, it's very limited. In the states that he goes to. But
back to your beloved Pennsylvania, Charlie.
Okay, going back to the Keystone State. Okay, so you've got a marquee Senate race there. You know, it really hasn't shaped up or ripened yet. It's not really on the top tier the way people may have expected it. But and Lou Barletta is a little bit of a Trump clone in that he was somebody who was banging the drum early on immigration before the rest of Congress. You know, you've got a vaguely vulnerable Democratic senator in Casey, a state that went for Trump. But do you think that Trump is an asset anywhere east of Harrisburg? No. Trump would be a disaster for Barletta. I mean, I think at some point they're going to have him in. Maybe they stick him in western Pennsylvania somewhere. But, you know, you can't have him anywhere near the Philadelphia media market because it would be a killer for Barletta. So the point is, you know, as long as he can't go in many competitive areas or is not an asset, the best possible use of the president is to just have him mint money for the party at these fundraisers.
James, I'm going to give you the last word here. What's kind of your one big thought, one big thing to look out for in terms of Trump getting involved in on your beat in the Senate over the next weeks and months?
Yeah, well, I want to kind of piggyback off what Charlie said earlier. I mean, you think about, we talked about, you know, these five states that President Trump won so overwhelmingly that have Democrats up. Those aren't really states that he's going to have to worry about in 2020 for reelect. They're states that overwhelmingly support him still. But you look at states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, that have Democratic senators up in 2018, then are states that the president won much more narrowly, Ohio more than those other three. But states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan were states that helped him win the presidency. They all are kind of falling off the map, or at least falling well out of the top tier in terms of Senate races for Republicans this year. It's going to be interesting to see if he tries to get involved there, tries to do some rallies in Michigan or Pennsylvania, tries to kind of, you know, keep his base energized in those states in 2018. Just as a sort of a precursor for what he's going to need for himself in 2020.
That's a really good point. All right. I think we can – I no better point to end it on, actually. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, great to be here.
And Nancy, thank you as always.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Charlie, thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
They call me Hal. They call me Stacy. They call me her. They call me Jane.
All right, as promised, we are going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan to take us out this week. Tim Groover, a former Politico Journalism Institute student, is going to help us out with the credits this week.
Nerdcast is produced by Michaela Rodriguez, with production help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and their illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Tim. Listeners, if you are a Nerdcast fan who wants to read the credits, let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. That's how Tim did it, and that's how you can do it, too. Thank you again for listening. We will talk to you again next week.
They call me Hal.